Let's have this tawfiq.
To visit or not visit.
We can have this tawfiq with closeness to the words of Allah in Al-Quran.
Yes.
Definitely Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Imam is thiql of Quran. Imam is something equal to Quran. So let's have all of our efforts for having this sort of closeness to Al-Quran as well.
Yes.
But having this, as I said, closeness to Imam is really, really important. I don't want to let down, to scold the importance of this issue.
Of course,
but
it's
Definitely. Yes. But I want to say that we know that whatever we do, Imam is seeing and watching it.
Yes.
So no worries for us to see him in person or through a hard contact.
Okay.
We need just to correct ourselves. This is Imam himself that comes to visit us.
Definitely.
I mean, this is his own statement that was said to one of the people who has been waiting for him for more than 20 years.
Yes.
That he said, if you correct yourselves, this is me coming to you to visit
you. Coming to you to visit you, that's right.
Yeah. Well,
and at least we must know that if we do not find a chance to visit him by doing the righteous deeds and the recommended actions, as you said, he is seeing us and he... Seeing us is also very important.
Definitely.
Okay, that's right. Thank you very much, Brother Alavyan.
You're welcome.
It was very kind of you. I really enjoyed talking to you. Really fruitful discussion related to Imam Alas. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode of the program, The Last Savior. God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Where is the rising sun?
Midstream.
It is evident that the ceasefire negotiations have entered a state of deadlock with conflicting paths toward collapse. Palestinian sources confirmed that the stumbling of the negotiations essentially began with the retreat of the four parties that prepared the Paris paper, namely the United States of America, Egypt, Qatar, and Zionist Israel, at the end of last January from the provisions of the paper. With the faltering of ceasefire agreements in Cairo and the escalation of the Israeli entity threats to expand ground operations towards the city of Rafah, the last area in southern Gaza that has yet to be entered by occupation tanks, the resistance has once again brought the fight back to the initial point, the city of Beit Hanun in the northernmost part of the Gaza Strip. While the Israeli occupation army assumed that the northern part of the strip was no longer a part of the confrontation since the major ground operations ended there 2 months ago, the Al-Qassam brigades managed to carry out qualitative operations. A drone belonging to the resistance dropped two bombs in the midst of a gathering of soldiers at the infiltration point north of Beit Hanun. Similarly, the military media of the Al-Qassam brigades distributed a video clip documenting a sniper operation targeting one of the enemy soldiers in the same axis. Meanwhile, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades announced that its fighters carried out artillery fortification operations using mortar shells, targeting enemy troops, gatherings, and vehicles in the combat axis in Beit Hanun as well. The military spokesperson of the Al-Qassam Brigades, Abu Ubaidah, appeared Friday, March 8 evening, delivering several important messages. Firstly, he stated that the October 7th operation was motivated by the obstruction of the most extremist and Nazi-like projects in the history of the occupation's entities' governments, notably those related to temporal and spatial division plans for the Al-Aqsa Mosque as a prelude to its confiscation. The second indication he mentioned was the enemy soldiers, both captives and those remaining, are suffering from starvation, similar to our people in Palestine as a result of the ongoing Israeli siege. Furthermore, Abu Ubaidah's speech conveyed a message that the resistance still controls the elements of the battlefield. It can be said that the integrity of the resistance's media apparatus, represented by the appearance of Abu Ubaidah as one of its icons, signifies that the rest of the field arms are still intact. Additionally, Abu Ubaidah outlined three conditions for accepting any exchange deal and ceasefire: the withdrawal of the enemy's occupation army from the Gaza Strip, freedom of movement for residents from north to south, and relief efforts coinciding with reconstruction. Abu Ubaidah's speech, which came days before the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, is now being interpreted as an indication of the resistance's determination to escalate the intensity of field pressure from all external and internal fronts, notably the West Bank and the occupied territories. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. With the return of Hamas delegation from Cairo following the failure of the latest round of negotiations on ceasefire and prisoner exchange between it and the occupation state, Palestinian sources confirm that what is proposed now does not meet the minimum demands of the resistance or the needs of the Gaza Strip for that matter, and that the resistance factions that authorized Hamas to take the appropriate stance had agreed with the leadership of the movement on the necessity of returning everyone to the first Paris paper. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Professor of Political Sociology at the Lebanese University, Dr. Hussein Rahal. It's a pleasure having you with us, Dr. Rahal. Now, according to the information from Cairo, the meetings of the new round, which were expected to be held this past Saturday with the participation of an Israeli entity delegation, have been basically postponed, if not failed, shattering hopes of possibly reaching any deal before the holy month or during the holy month of Ramadan. Amid what Egypt says are fears of its own of turning the current situation in Gaza into a permanent one. But was there hope actually that these talks would be successful to begin with?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. Hopes were few for many reasons, first among them being Zionist stubbornness and unwillingness to cease aggression against Gaza. The second reason is the lack of seriousness from the Americans in pressuring the Israeli entity, with pressure only focused on the Palestinian side by the Americans and also by countries considering themselves mediators, which contributed to the failure or diminished hopes of success in these negotiations, because what was required was to acknowledge outcomes in favor of the Zionist enemy that the occupying army couldn't achieve militarily. Yes, the occupation indeed killed civilians and committed massacres reaching the level of genocide, but militarily they couldn't reach their announced battle goals. Therefore, they wanted to give the killer and the butcher political gifts and strategic gains at the expense of the steadfastness and sacrifices of the Palestinian people. Hence, these negotiations were viewed from the beginning as difficult and might not lead to results, with the Israeli entity possibly exploiting them to achieve gains at the expense of the Palestinian people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Hussein, officials involved in this negotiation round, they were saying that on the field, pressures exerted by the resistance to potentially cause a breach were awaited to at least influence maybe the losses incurred by the occupation and its failure to achieve any of its goals, the covert and overt goals for Gaza, in addition to internal Israeli entity pressure as well that is mounting as we speak. How do you think the sight of resistance fighters, Palestinian resistance fighters re-emerging again in the northernmost part of Gaza, in Beit Hanun, if any, hit the Zionists while they are preparing to invade supposedly south in Rafah after maybe thinking that the northern part has already been dealt with and there's no longer any potential threat against the Zionist entity in the north?
نعم في الحقيقة هذه المسألة تؤرق الجيش الصهيوني.
Yes, indeed. This issue troubles the Zionist army. There is frustration at many levels among officers or former officers who work as political advisors for Zionist parties. The resurgence and control of Palestinian resistance fighters in many areas in northern Gaza confirm the failure of the Israeli entity announcement of its success in cleansing these areas of fighters, and fully illustrates that the occupation army couldn't actually reach the leaders or the captured Zionists or establish real control within these areas. Here, we see a major military failure of the Israeli occupation army. Therefore, Israeli Zionists resort to taking Palestinian civilians as hostages. they pressure civilians and destroy infrastructure in exchange for this military failure. Whenever the occupation army senses its failure to achieve actual military objectives, you find it retaliating against civilians, increasing its bombardment of infrastructure, and adopting a policy of starvation to counterbalance the resistance's resilience. The Israeli entity aims to use 2.5 million Palestinian citizens as hostages, either killing them or crippling the resistance. This is terrorism, an act only carried out by gangs and road bandits, not by any state in the world. Unfortunately, this policy receives actual American support regardless of the criticism voiced by President Biden against Netanyahu, because Biden clearly and explicitly states that there are no red lines for the Israeli entity in this battle and that he hasn't cut off military supplies sent to the Israeli entity. In this case, we find that the Israeli entity relies on a policy of destroying what remains of infrastructure in Rafah. They don't want to leave Palestinians with any infrastructure that would allow them to return to normal life in case the fighting stops. And this is indeed a serious matter, falling within the framework of comprehensive human extermination.
Well, communications between Egyptians and Zionist Israelis, Dr. Hussein, witnessed repeated Israeli entity demands to open the Rafah crossing only for the passage of thousands of Palestinians into the Egyptian borders, temporarily, as they say, which we don't believe, for a specific period of time to be agreed upon. Why not just agree to open the border first for the food, for the aid, for the medicine that the Palestinian people in Gaza severely need? Why are the parties involved in the talks with the Zionist entity allowing the Zionist entity to keep the border in Rafah closed in the faces of the Palestinians, in the faces of any aid that would come to the Palestinians? Why are they so okay with this? Why is this okay for them?
At night, Netanyahu announced that the construction of the seaport was his idea, which reinforces the occupation, because Israeli entity soldiers would be stationed there to deliver what is called aid, while also denying the existence of any starvation inside Gaza. This is a real disconnect from reality and the disregard for the human spirit of the Palestinian people. Yes, Rafah crossing can be open to provide aid, which is the easiest, most effective, and most humane solution. Unfortunately, there is a Zionist American decision to prevent the opening of this crossing. It's worth mentioning that many Palestinians leave through this crossing by bribing Egyptian officers stationed there to temporarily or permanently leave. However, unfortunately, the Egyptian decision still prohibits the entry of aid without American and Israeli permission. This is indeed surprising even to the Egyptian people. We notice that during this period, there are pressures on Egypt from various aspects, including financial temptations. For example, from the United Arab Emirates to maintain the stance of preventing the reinforcement of the resilience of the Palestinian people within the sector, as this resilience could lead to a complete failure of the Zionist invasion. This is a surprising matter that cannot be understood neither from a humanitarian nor from a legal perspective, because Egypt owns the Rafah crossing and controls the land border route where any crossing can be established. But it hesitates to do so because it falls within the framework of American policy. The primary fear here in Gaza is the implementation of a Zionist goal, which is the displacement of the population. This is a goal that the Israeli entity has not retreated from, and I don't know to what extent the Egyptian government can withstand the immense pressure it faces. As we have seen, it could be much easier to accomplish than sending aid that kills people from hunger, or waiting 60 days to secure the port. We have a clear crossing that could be the real alternative to delivering aid, and this is very detrimental to the Egyptian situation and to the Arab countries, and it's utterly condemnable.
Definitely, Professor of Political Sociology at the Lebanese University, Dr. Hussein Rahal, thank you very much for being with us to discuss this very pressing issue at the moment in Palestine. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about how the U.S. is complicit in genocide in Gaza.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the United States of America has behaved in this way, knowing that Zionist Israel from the very beginning has carried out crimes against humanity amounting to genocide, such as targeting civilians and seeking to ethnically cleanse the Gaza population. Hence, Americans must think through whether they are willing to carry on with this policy of passive permissiveness and perhaps one day even face a legal accusation that they were participants in the genocide by Zionist Israel in the Gaza Strip. More details in this following report.
The United States of America is attempting to reshape the narrative in Gaza, portraying the current Democratic administration as the one innovating solutions to aid civilians in the Strip, after Zionist Israel, the primary Zionist ally, killed and injured over 100,000 Palestinians in Gaza. President Joe Biden, who last week reaffirmed his eternal support for Zionist Israel, has also displaced around 2 million Palestinians, demolished their homes, schools, hospitals, and orphanages, uprooted and destroyed their infrastructure, rendering their cities and towns uninhabitable. Not only that, they were also besieged, starved, and then killed as they tried to obtain some meager food that falls from the sky, only to be killed by one of the deadly projectiles raining down from the sky. As internal pressures increase in the United States, Biden innovated, with the assistance of consultation of the Zionist Israelis, of course, the idea of a maritime bridge from the coasts of Cyprus to the coasts of Gaza, in an old-new project with entirely inhumane objectives. Mind you, the border with Egypt is right there, and all what is really needed is for the border to be opened. There is not an iota of doubt that the United States of America can stop the carnage and famine in Gaza, but has not done so. Surely this makes it complicit in the genocide there. As the horror in Gaza continues, Americans in particular should repeat one simple proposition to themselves. Their government is complicit in prolonging an unnecessary war in which their close ally Zionist Israel is actively engaged in starving the Palestinian population of Gaza into submission. The United States of America, the supposed pillar of an international rules-based order who has deafened us that only it holds the vanguard of humanitarian interventions worldwide, is today the patron of a regime that is indifferent to even the most basic humanitarian principles. 5 months into the Gaza slaughter, the United States of America is to a large extent responsible for what is taking place. Any remarks coming from any U.S. official at this point is just a vain attempt at a whitewash. Washington has persisted in vetoing all UN resolutions calling for a ceasefire. It has opposed the South African case before the International Court of Justice, ICJ, accusing Zionist Israel of genocide. And it has continued to supply the Israeli regime with the weapons its occupation forces are using to bomb civilians in Gaza. The U.S. has the latitude to withhold arms shipments to Zionist Israel and compel the Zionist regime to accept a ceasefire, but instead has blocked all permanent ceasefire proposals. The U.S. has the leverage to push Zionist Israel to implement the ICJ's interim decision, but instead has chosen to discredit the court's ruling. The United States of America has acknowledged that Zionist Israel is, at the very least, limiting the entry of food into Gaza, which even Israeli entity organizations have identified as a policy of starvation, but has persisted in publicly supporting those responsible for this outrage. The United States of America is as guilty in genocide as Zionist Israel is. Point.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Moscow is Fiorella Isabel, journalist, geopolitical analyst, host at the Convo Couch, and writer at the Fiorella Isabel Substack. Thanks a million for being with us this morning, Fiorella. Now, the Zionist inhumane war, at least to say in Gaza, has provoked a legal vortex that encompasses the possibility of acts of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Now, the United States of America officially knows that, and yet still chooses to shrug at the thought of a ceasefire while still arming the Zionist entity to its teeth. What makes the U.S. administration, Fiorella, indifferent to the facts that I just said? Is it that they know that there will be no ramifications against them whatsoever?
Right. So thank you for having me. Not only will they not have any ramifications, this is par and parcel to their policy that is necessary for the United States to continue having its military contingent in West Asia. And this is precisely what the Biden administration knows, that they cannot forego their Zionist lobbyists. Because if you understand the American government, you understand that these lobbyists run the entire government, not just Zionist lobbyists, but corporate lobbyists. And among them, of course, Biden has to assure that he's going to continue getting the support of AIPAC, that he's going to continue getting what is necessary to, quote unquote, get him over the top of Donald Trump, who has now won the Republican nomination. And so when you're looking at this from that perspective, Joe Biden is positioning these acts now with these new ports and with the actions of really not really going after Israel, but verbally saying, well, we need to stop attacking the civilians, we need to continue to deliver aid. Well, all that they're looking at is what he's saying, not what he's doing. And in comparison to Donald Trump, he's trying to position himself as somebody that is a little bit more sympathetic to Gaza, to Palestinians, but still, at the end of the day, does the bidding that Israel needs. And so will there be any ramifications from international institutions, from any of these individuals and organizations that say they are, you know, appalled by what's happening in Gaza and who have debated whether to call it a genocide or not for nearly 6 months now? And nothing will come out of it because the United States and Israel are the ones that lead these institutions. Israel is under the protection of the United States, therefore nothing will come.
But Fiorella, what's really very interesting is that it has been acknowledged by everyone at this point, even by Zionist entity NGOs and civil society, that Zionist Israel is using starvation as a means to as a means of submission against the people of Gaza. And yet the U.S. has persisted in publicly supporting those responsible for this outrage in Gaza. And now, instead of opening the borders with Egypt and allowing the aid in, they are suggesting a maritime aid bridge that starts in Cyprus and gets into Gaza. But what is stopping them from pressuring the Zionists into a ceasefire and opening wide from every corner with the borders of Gaza? I mean, they can even open the borders with Gaza with the illegal Zionist settlements, not only with Egypt, but they are persistent in the siege.
Right. But what's stopping them is their goal, because Israel is there to meet the objectives and goals of the United States military. That is all it is there for. That's its own. That's the reason why it was created. We're talking about Israel has verbally said that they're going to expand into Lebanon, like as they have already been doing. They're going to go after Syria, Iran. This is all not just Israel. This is part of the U.S. plan to take over this entire region. And so they need Israel there. So, of course, Biden, the administration, and the entire State Department are having to do this sort of, this is a humanitarian act. When, as you know, Marwa, have we seen actual humanitarian actions from the United States? It doesn't exist. This is all a guise. This is all a facade to really continue pushing their military strategies on the region. So what's actually stopping them is their own military goals, their own objectives. They have zero desire to actually help Palestinians in Gaza. They would have done this hundreds of thousands of victims of ago if they actually cared. And they're not doing this because that's not their objective. Their objective is to appear compassionate, to appear like they're actually trying to get this aid in. But as you said, they could do this in a completely different way. But no, this is about military targets and establishing these military targets in order to do what they need to do. And of course, also appear compassionate in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Fiorella, we have under international law the Article 54 of the Additional Protocol of June 1977 of the Geneva Conventions and Article 8 as well of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court that using starvation as a weapon of war is prohibited and considered a war crime. Now, the Israeli entity is responsible for the starvation. We have heard some of the officials of the Biden administration saying that this needs to stop, like, for example, Kamala Harris, who said that people in Gaza are starving, the conditions are inhumane, and our community, our common humanity compels us to act. But if the U.S. is not acting upon its words, why do they say them even though? I mean, if it's only for votes, then why do they say them when they can compel them into action? If there's any way now to pressure the Biden administration into obliging Zionist Israel to stop the genocide against Gaza, what is that way? What can the people do?
Right. The only thing the American people can do right now is continue their efforts in going outside of the electoral system, because there is no pressure that the government feels from the American public, because they're not representing the American public. The government is clearly representing these lobbyists, representing these institutions that are very powerful. They have zero representation to the American public, because as you've seen, there have been so many protests, so many people protesting, so many people saying we're not okay with this. Even from the beginning of this genocide to now, we have seen more and more people say, wait a minute, I don't want my tax dollars going to this. We saw what happened with Aaron Bushnell and that way he protested, because he said, I don't want to be take a part in this genocide. So more and more people of the United States are actually against what is happening, but they have zero ways to pressure, because the American system is not it's not giving them any sort of ability to pressure Biden outside of protesting, outside of going and doing these things. So more than protesting, they need to actually attack the levers of power. What I have seen is attacking the ships that are getting going from American ports to supply weapons to Israel. These sort of things need to happen. There needs to be direct confrontation with those in power. Now, I'm not talking about just random representatives. I'm talking about those directly with the Israel lobby. And that's the only thing that's going to continue putting pressure, but it has to be in a huge amount, and it has to be directed at the economics, which is why what we've seen with Ansarallah being the most devastating effect towards Israel and the United States, because that's attacking their economics. And that's honestly the best way. The American public is not largely in favor of what's happening, but they actually don't even know what to do. And at this point, they largely are complicit, because not much is getting done. And again, this is not something that is surprising. The United States will say these words of compassion. They will say that they want to stop what Israel is doing, then simultaneously give Israel the funds and the military apparatus that it needs to continue, because they are the ones that need this to happen just as much as Israel does.
Mm-hmm. Well, Fiorella Isabel, journalist, geopolitical analyst, and writer at the Fiorella Isabel Substack, thank you very much for being with us. Ladies and gents, thank you. And Ramadan Mubarak to you and all of your loved ones. Hopefully this Ramadan will be the last Ramadan where Palestine is not free. Hopefully next year will be the Free Palestine year. We'll see you again next week right here on the Mideast Stream.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
The British government will announce a plan to increase gas power capacity by providing extra certainty to investors that plants have a long-term future, even as Britain moves away from fossil fuels. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak risks further criticism from Green campaigners after throwing his weight behind the building of new gas-fired power stations, saying he will not gamble with our energy security. The government will announce a plan to increase gas power capacity by providing extra certainty to investors that plants have a long-term future, even as Britain moves away from fossil fuels. Ministers said it represented a common-sense decision to ensure power supplies kept flowing during the transition to net zero. They argued that gas plants were a safe and reliable source of energy when weather conditions did not power wind and solar farms. The government claimed that the move would not impact net zero targets. However, critics are likely to see it as a backward step in the wider push to decarbonise Britain's power network through renewable energy projects. Some big energy firms have deserted the gas industry in recent years to focus on renewable energies, which have a more certain future. Last year, gas accounted for 32% of Great Britain's electricity generation, ahead of 29% from wind power and 14% from nuclear power. The last remaining coal-burning plant at Ratcliffe on Soar in Nottinghamshire is due to close in September. Renewable industry backers argue the investment in battery projects, which can store electricity when weather conditions are unfavourable, is vital to make the system more reliable. The Energy Secretary, Claire Coutinho, is expected to set out her strategy for gas at a speech at the think tank Chatham House in central London in the coming days. She will say, without gas backing up renewables, we face the genuine prospect of blackouts. Other countries in recent years have been so threatened by supply constraints that they have been forced back to coal. Claire Coutinho, the Energy Secretary, added, there are no easy solutions in energy, only trade-offs. If countries are forced to choose between clean energy and keeping citizens safe and warm, believe me, they'll choose to keep the lights on. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story. Jess Ralston, an energy analyst at the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit think tank, says the UK Secretary of State suggesting that if Britons cannot control energy prices, then they are not secure as a country, while announcing new gas power stations has a real irony about it. Jess Ralston added, anyone paying an energy bill in the past 2 years knows that the United Kingdom doesn't control the price we pay for gas, that international markets decide. Energy security has shot up the political agenda since Russia cut off gas exports to Europe after the start of war with Ukraine in 2022. European sanctions against Moscow have left countries scrambling to secure new supplies of energy. And household bills have soared. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak says we need to reach our 2035 goal in a sustainable way that doesn't leave people without energy on a cloudy, windless day. I will not gamble with our energy security. The Prime Minister's intervention appears to be his latest effort to win votes by pushing back on green policies. The switch to green power has also become a contentious political point, with the Conservatives pledging to decarbonise power generation by 2035 and Labour by 2030. Both political parties envisage gas-fired plants will play a small part in providing backup power supplies even after those dates, as Britain prepares for a surge in electricity demand despite recent delays to renewable energy and nuclear projects. The Shadow Energy Secretary Ed Miliband said, "Of course we need to replace retiring gas-fired stations as part of a decarbonized power system, which will include carbon capture and hydrogen playing a limited backup role in the system." But he said the reason the Tories cannot deliver the lower bills and energy security we need is that they're specialists in failure when it comes to our clean energy future, persisting with a ludicrous ban on onshore wind, bungling the offshore wind auctions and failing on energy efficiency. Juliet Phillips of the climate think tank E3G says, "Due to policy failures over the last parliament, the government has missed opportunities to build out the full offshore wind pipeline, to make gains in energy efficiency or address clunky network connection times, all factors that mean new gas plants have been announced." Britain's Energy Secretary Claire Coutinho plans to claim that the laws ensuring new-built plants are net-zero ready will be broadened to encompass hydrogen, allowing gas plants to switch to a new fuel source. Power plants are already due to command record prices to keep the lights on after an auction recently. Rules will also be updated around the capacity market, which sets prices for payments to electricity generators, to incentivise gas plant operators. Ministers do not now plan to introduce lower emission limits in the market for new built and refurbished executive plants until 2026 at the earliest. However, one chief of gas plant operators said the changes were unlikely to trigger a new wave of plants. They said, "In reality, we can keep updating plants which are nearing the end of their lives at relatively low cost." Energy Secretary Claire Coutinho's speech coincides with a second consultation on review of electricity market arrangements, a set of wide-ranging changes. It is expected to propose zonal pricing, which will allow renewable energy developers to charge higher rates if they build wind and solar farms close to cities, where demand is greater. Separately, the industry regulator Ofgem said on Monday 11th of March it was concerned that costs linked to net zero could disproportionately hit lower income consumers.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Manajat, the host of this program, and Shacha with our guest speaker. We are going to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to the blessed month of Ramadan and fasting with Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, somebody asked Sheikh, I don't know exactly when I reached the age of Sharia puberty. Would you please clarify the time from which it is obligatory for me to perform the qada of missed prayers and fasts?
Well, of course, if you are a boy, then you must see whether you have completed 15 lunar years or not, or maybe you have ejaculated in your sleep, or you had a nightfall or not, or maybe if you have hair around the genital area, that means you have hit puberty, and then fasting.
Yeah.
That means you you should perform your legal duties and act like adults. So if you do not know when you actually hit puberty, and that is another issue, of course, according to His Eminence, you are responsible only for the qada of the prayers and fast, actually. And the qada of the prayers and fast, which you are certain to have been missed. Now, for example, you are certain that you have lost, like the prayers and fast of the last 1 month, okay? And you hit puberty like 30 days ago. That's what you are certain about. But you are not certain about that the months before 30 days.
Yes.
Then it becomes obligatory for you to give the qada of those days of fasting and prayers about which you are certain. As for those prayers and fast about which you are not certain, for example, yes, last year when it comes to last year, you are not sure whether you had hit puberty or not, then it's not obligatory and to do anything, and the qada of those days is not necessary to be given.
Thank you. Sheikh Sabit, a 9-year-old girl on whom it is obligatory to fast, this girl breaks her fast because fasting is too hard for her, right? You know, does she have to perform the qada of the fast?
Yeah, of course, it is necessary that she perform the qada of the Ramadan fast that she broke. Okay, she broke it, but it was wajib on her to fast. Okay, she was justified in breaking her fast because she was unable to fast. And la yukallifu Allahu nafsan illa wus'aha. So, but of course, she must give the qada. The same is the case with prayer. If you, because of some problem, you missed your prayer, that doesn't mean you are not supposed to perform the qada. Later on, it is necessary to observe the qada of the fast or the prayer that you missed.
Okay. Someone with a strong excuse, let's say 50% probability, doubted that fasting was obligatory for him, so he did not fast. Later became clear to the same individual that fasting was obligatory for him at that time. What's the ruling, Sheikh, in relation to performing the qada and paying kafar?
Well, if someone breaks a fast in the month of Ramadan merely due to the possibility that fasting may not be obligatory for him, and he continues to have this doubt, and it actually he must carry out the qada and pay the kafara as well, because he should have made sure that he had hit puberty, and he deliberately ignored fasting. So in that case, actually, he should also give a penalty in addition to the qada that is obligatory on him. But if someone did not fast out of the rational fear that fasting would be harmful for him, of course, then it is not necessary for him to pay kafara, and the qada only becomes obligatory.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. Marhaba ya Ramadan, أحيي قلوبنا بالله.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the blessed month of Ramadan with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, a person performing military service or doing the military service could not fast during Ramadan last year. Because of frequent, for example, traveling and being stationed at base and what have you. As Ramadan approaches this year, he's still serving in the same area and does not think he'll be able to fast this year either. Does he have to pay the kafara after leaving the service in addition to performing the qada of those fasts?
Well, being in a place of a military service per se does not justify not fasting or even ignoring one's duty to fast. Every individual who is not traveling and who is not considered to be a traveler and who stays at a place, for example, someone is a military base and he is supposed to stay there for at least 10 days, he's not a traveler. He, even if he's going and coming back and forth, so he should actually observe fast. There's no way he can skip his duty of fasting. Mm-hmm. In the event that he, of course, he breaks his fast, thinking that, okay, he is justified in breaking it, he should not only make up the missed fast, but he should also give kafara. Kafara, he becomes obligatory on him, and of course we know that the kafara is very difficult to pay. He should, let's say, feed 60 poor people, or maybe he should set a slave free. Of course, in this time around, we don't have any slaves to be freed. But also, if he can do, he should fast for let's say 60 days. Because of fast, breaking his fast deliberately. Now, if he has to give the qada of the fast until next Ramadan, in the event that he fails to give the qada of the fast of Ramadan until next Ramadan, there is another kafara, which is the kafara for delaying the qada of the fast, the kafara for postponing and putting off the procrastinating. You are thinking, okay, today I will give the qada tomorrow, and then you keep procrastinating, and then you become liable for the kafara.
It's a kind of fine or punishment, basically.
Yes, a kind of punishment, yes.
And is it different from the kafara in amount?
Yeah, in terms of amount, it is only 750 grams. Uh-huh. And it's not repeated, don't observe the qada, and even then in the following years, the kafara is not repeated.
I see.
You have to give only 750 grams per day.
Thank you. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and Ramadan. Sheikh Javid, a fasting person is unaware that he's in state of janaba. In the afternoon, he notices and performs usl by immersion. Does this invalidate his fast? And if he realizes what he has done only after performing the ghusl, does he have to perform or offer the qadla of the fast?
Well, if one performs ghusl by immersion out of forgetfulness, mm-hmm. Forgetfulness in terms of the fact that he is actually fasting,
mm-hmm.
Unintentionally, let's say, then both his fast and ghusl are valid, because of course, according to many other scholars, mm-hmm. ghusl by way of immersion does not invalidate the fast. For example, right. Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that immersing your body completely underwater will not affect your ghusl, but
even your head.
That's the point, actually. But His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may he live long, is of the view that as long as you keep your head out, there's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not called immersion, ghusl by way of immersion.
Yes.
This is called actually...
bathing.
Bathing, a kind of. You know, you just immerse your body and your head is out.
Yes.
That's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So if you forgetfully do it, it will not affect your fasting. Not only your fast is valid, but also your ghusl by way of immersion is correct and valid.
Mm-hmm. What about the later part of my question? Does he have to offer the qadha of the fast? Basically, not?
No, there's no qadha, of course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay. A person who is fasting had planned to reach his place of residence before noon adhan. But along the way, he came across an accident that delayed him. Hence, he did not reach his residence in time. Is his fast valid? Does he have to pay kafara or will perform the qada? Will performing the qada be sufficient?
Well, the truth of the matter is that as long as you are a traveler, you cannot make niyyah fasting. And for example, if you are traveling before noon and you are, for example, some 20 kilometers or even more kilometers away from your home, you cannot make niyyah fasting. So maybe you have the intention to fast, but that intention is invalid in the first place. So in that case, of course, your fast is invalid because you are a traveler, and it will be obligatory for you to perform the qadha of fasting for the day in which you are traveling. And you are far away from your home, and there's no kafar actually to be paid.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, as the host of this program. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. 'Cause Ramadan is here. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Of the soil from the blood and the ashes. It speaks with me the sound of the rain from the battle and the victory.
This is